the American asked. Information like this was a state secret equivalent to the inner thoughts of President Grushevoy. There is no hiding it from you. I assume you tell everything we do together to Washington, and it was you who identified the Chinese diplomat for which I and my country are in your debt. The amusing part of that was that Riley had darted off to track Suvorov/Konyev without a thought, just as a cop thing, to help out a brother cop. Only afterward, about a nanosecond afterward, of course, had he thought of the political implications. And he'd thought this far ahead, but only as speculation, not quite believing that it could possibly have gone this far forward. "Well, yes, I have to keep the Bureau informed of my operations here," the legal attaché admitted. Not that it was an earth-shaking revelation. "I know that, Mishka." "The Chinese wanted to kill Golovko," Riley whispered into his vodka. "Fuck." "My word exactly," Provolov told his American friend. "The question is..." "Two questions, Oleg. First, why? Second, now what? Third, who is Suvorov? And what is he up to?" Which was obvious, Riley thought. Was Suvorov merely a paid agent of a foreign country? Or was he part of the KGB wing of the Russian mafia being paid by the Chinese to do something? But what? And to what purpose? "You know, I've been hunting OC guys for a long time. But it never got anywhere near this big. This is right up there with all those bullshit stories about who really killed Kennedy." Provolov's eyes looked up. "You're not saying..." "No, Oleg, the mafia isn't that crazy. You don't go around looking to make enemies that big. You can't predict the consequences, and it isn't good for business. The mafia is a business, Oleg. They try to make money for themselves. Even their political protection is aimed only at that, and that has limits, and they know what the limits are." "So if Suvorov is mafia, then he is only trying to make money?" "Here it's a little different," Riley said slowly, trying to help his brain keep up with his mouth. "Here your OC guys think more politically than they do in New York. And the reason for that was that the KGB types had all grown up in an intensely political environment. Here politics really was power in a more direct sense than it had ever been in America, where politics and commerce had always been somewhat separate, the former protecting the latter, for a fee, but also controlled by it. Here it had always been and still remained the other way around. Business needed to rule politics because business was the source of prosperity, from which the citizens of a country derived their comforts. Russia had never prospered because the cart kept trying to pull the horse. The recipient of the wealth had always tried to generate that wealth, and political figures are always pretty hopeless in that department. They are only good at squandering it. Politicians live by their political theories. Businessmen use reality and have to perform in a world defined by reality, not theory. That was why, even in America, they understood one another poorly and never really trusted one another. "What makes Golovko a target? What's the profit in killing him?" Riley asked aloud.
"He is the chief advisor to President Grushevoy. He's never wanted to be an elected official and therefore cannot be a minister per se. But he has the president's ear because he is both intelligent and honest. And he's a patriot in the true sense."
Despite his background, Riley didn't add.
Golovko was KGB, formerly a deadly enemy to the West, and an enemy to President Ryan. But somewhere along the line they'd met each other and they'd come to respect each other. Even like each other, so the stories in Washington went. Riley finished off his second vodka and waved for another. He was turning into a Russian, the FBI agent thought. It was getting to the point that he couldn't hold an intelligent conversation without a drink or two. "So get him and thereby hurt your president and thereby hurt your entire country. Still, it's one hell of a dangerous play, Oleg Grigorievich."
"A very dangerous play, Mishka," Provolov agreed. "Who would do such a thing?"
Riley let out a long and speculative breath. "One very ambitious motherfucker." He had to get back to the embassy and light up his Stew-6 in one big fucking hurry. He'd tell Director Murray, and Murray would tell President Ryan in half a New York minute. Then what? It was way the hell over his head, Mike Riley thought. Okay, you're covering this Suvorov guy. We and the Federal Security Service now, Provolov confirmed. They good?
Very, the militia lieutenant admitted.
Suvorov can't fart without us knowing what he had to eat.
And you have his communications penetrated?
Oleg nodded.
The written kind.
He has a cell phone, maybe more than one, and covering them can be troublesome.
Especially if he has an encryption system on it. There's stuff commercially available now that our people have a problem with.
Oh? Provolov's head came around.
He was surprised for two reasons. First, that there was a reliable encryption system available for cell phones, and second, that the Americans had trouble cracking it.
Riley nodded.
Fortunately, the bad guys haven't found out yet. Contrary to popular belief, the Mafia wasn't all that adept at using technology. Microwaving their food was about as far as they went. One Mafia don had thought his cell phone secure because of its frequency-hopping abilities, and then had entirely canceled that supposed advantage out by standing still while using it. The dunce don had never figured that out, even after the intercept had been played aloud in federal district court.
We haven't noticed any of that yet.
Keep it that way, Riley advised. Anyway, you have a national security investigation.
It's still murder and conspiracy to commit murder, Provolov said, meaning it was still his case.
Anything I can do?
Think it over. You have good instincts for Mafia cases, and that is probably what it is.
Riley tossed off his last drink.
Okay, I'll see you tomorrow, right here?
Oleg nodded.
Well, that is good.
The FBI agent walked back outside and got into his car. 10 minutes later, he was at his desk. He took the plastic key from his desk drawer and inserted it into the Stew, then dialed Washington. All manner of people with Stew phones had access to Murray's private secure number, and so when the large system behind his desk started chirping, he just picked it up and listened to the hiss of static for 30 seconds until the robotic voice announced,
"Line is secure."
"Murray," he said.
"Riley in Moscow," the other voice said.
The FBI director checked his desk clock. It was pretty damn late there.
"What's happening, Mike?" he asked.
Then got the word in 3 fast-spoken minutes.
"Yeah, Ellen?" Ryan said when the buzzer went off.
"The AG and the FBI director want to come over on something important," they said. "You have an opening in 40 minutes.
"Fair enough."
Ryan didn't wonder what it was about. He'd find out quickly enough. When he realized what he'd just thought, he cursed the presidency once more. He was becoming jaded.
In this job?
"What the hell?" Ed Foley observed.
"Seems to be solid information, too," Murray told the DCI.
"What else do you know?"
"The facts just came in, only 2 pages and nothing much more than what I just told you. But I'll send it over to you. I've told Riley to offer total cooperation."
"Anything to offer from your side?" Dan asked.
"Nothing comes to mind. This is all news to us, Dan. My congrats to your man Riley for turning it."
Foley was an information whore, after all. He'd take from anybody.
"Good kid. His father was a good agent, too."
Murray knew better than to be smug about it, and Foley didn't deserve the abuse. Things like this were not actually within CIA's purview and not likely to be tumbled to by one of their operations. For his part, Foley wondered if he'd have to tell Murray about Zorga. If this was for real, it had to be known at the very highest levels of the Chinese government. It wasn't a freelance operation by their Moscow station. People got shot for fucking around at this level, and such an operation would not even occur to communist bureaucrats, who were not the most inventive people in the world.
"Anyway, I'm taking Pat Martin over with me.
He knows espionage operations from the defensive side, and I figure I'll need the backup.
Okay, thanks. Let me go over the facts, and I'll be back to you later today.
He could hear the nod at the other end. Right, Ed. See ya. His secretary came in 30 seconds later with a fax in a folder. Ed Foley checked the cover sheet and called his wife in from her office. Chapter 35 Breaking News.
Shit, Ryan observed quietly when Murray handed him the fax from Moscow.
Shit, he added on further reflection. Is this for real?
We think so, Jack, the FBI director confirmed. He and Ryan went back more than 10 years, and so he was able to use the first name. He filled in a few facts.
Our boy Riley, he's an OC expert. That's why we sent him over there. But he has FCI experience, too, also in the New York office.
He's good, Jack, Murray assured his president.
He's going places. He's established a very good working relationship with the local cops. Help them out on some investigations, held their hands like we do with local cops over here, you know.
And?
And this looks gold-plated, Jack.
Somebody tried to put a hit on Sergei Nikolaevich, and it looks as though it was an agency of the Chinese government.
Jesus. Rogue operation?
If so, we'll find out when some Chinese minister dies of a sudden cerebral hemorrhage, induced by a bullet in the back of the head, Murray told the president.
Has Ed Foley seen this yet?
I called it in and sent the fax over, so yeah, he's seen it.
Pat?
Ryan turned to the Attorney General, the smartest lawyer Ryan had yet met, and that included all of his Supreme Court appointees.
Mr. President, this is a stunning revelation. Again, if we assume it's true, and not some sort of false flag provocation, or a play by the Russians to make something happen. Problem is, I can't see the rationale for such a thing.
We appear to be faced with something that's too crazy to be true, and too crazy to be false as well. I've worked foreign counterintelligence operations for a long time. I've never seen nothing like this before. We've always had an understanding with the Russians that they wouldn't hit anybody in Washington, and we wouldn't hit anybody in Moscow, and to the best of my knowledge, that agreement was never violated by either side. But this thing here, if it's real, it's tantamount to an act of war. That doesn't seem like a very prudent thing for the Chinese to do either, does it?
POTUS looked up from the fax.
It says here that your guy Riley turned the connection with the Chinese.
Keep reading, Murray told him.
He was there during a surveillance and just kind of volunteered his services, and bingo.
But can the Chinese really be this crazy?
Ryan's voice trailed off.
This isn't the Russians messing with our heads, he asked.
What would be the rationale behind that? Martin asked.
If there is one, I don't see it.
Guys, nobody is this crazy, POTUS nearly exploded. It was penetrating all the way into his mind now. The world wasn't rational yet.
Again, sir, that's something you're better equipped to evaluate than we are, Martin observed.
It had the effect of calming Jack down a few notches.
All the time I spent at Langley, I saw a lot of strange material, but this one really takes the prize.
What do we know about the Chinese? Murray asked, expecting to hear a reply along the lines of jack shit, because the Bureau had not experienced conspicuous success in its efforts to penetrate Chinese intelligence operations in America, and figured that the agency had the same problem, and for much the same reason. Americans of Chinese ethnicity weren't thick in government service. But instead he saw that President Ryan instantly adopted a guarded look and said nothing. Murray had interviewed thousands of people during his career, and along the way had picked up the ability to read minds a little bit. He read Ryan's right then and wondered about what he saw there.
Not enough, Dan.
Not enough, Ryan replied tardily. His mind was still churning over this report. Pat Martin had put it right. It was too crazy to be true and too crazy to be false. He needed the Foleys to go over this for him, and it was probably time to get Professor Weaver down from Brown University.
Assuming Ed and Mary Pat wouldn't throw a complete hissy fit over letting him into both Sorga and this FBI bombshell. Swordsman wasn't sure of much right now, but he was sure that he needed to figure this stuff out and do it damned fast. American relations with China had just gone down the shitter, and now he had information to suggest they were making a direct attack on the Russian government. Ryan looked up at his guests.
Thanks for this, guys. If you have anything else to tell me, let me know as quick as you can. I have to ponder this one.
Yeah, I believe it, Jack. I've told Riley to offer all the assistance he can and report back. They know he's doing that, of course. So your pal Golovko wants you to know this one. How you handle that one's up to you, I suppose.
Yeah, I get all the simple calls.
Jack managed a smile. The worst part was the inability to talk things over with people in a timely way. Things like this weren't for the telephone. You wanted to see a guy's face and body language when you picked his brain. Her brain, in MP's case, on a topic like this one. He hoped George Weaver was as smart as everyone said. Right now he needed a witch. The new security pass was entirely different from his old SDI one, and he was heading for a different Pentagon office. This was the Navy section of the Pentagon. You could tell by all the blue suits and serious looks. Each of the uniformed services had a different corporate mentality. In the U.S. Army, everyone was from Georgia. In the Air Force, they were all from Southern California. In the Navy, they all seemed to be swamp Yankees. And so it was here in the Aegis program office. Gregory had spent most of the morning with a couple of serious commander rank officers who seemed smart enough, though both were praying aloud to get the hell back on a ship and out to sea, just as Army officers always wanted to get back out in the field where there was mud to put on your boots and you had to dig a hole to piss in. But that's where the soldiers were, and any officer worth his salt wanted to be where the soldiers were. For sailors, Gregory imagined it was salt water and fish, and probably better food than the MREs inflicted on the guys in BDUs. But from his conversations with the squids, he'd learned much of what he'd already known. The Aegis radar missile system had been developed to deal with the Russian airplane and cruise missile threat to the Navy's aircraft carriers. It entailed a superb phased array radar called the SPY, and a fair-to-midland surface-to-air missile originally called the Standard Missile, because, Gregory imagined, it was the only one the Navy had. The Standard had evolved from the SM-1 to the SM-2, actually called the SM-2MR because it was a medium-range missile instead of an ER, or extended-range one, which had a booster stage to kick it out of the ship's launch cells a little faster and farther. There were about 200 of the ER versions sitting in various storage sheds for the Atlantic and Pacific fleets, because full protection had never been approved. Because, somebody thought, the SM-2ER might violate the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which had, however, been signed with a country called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which country, of course, no longer existed. But after the 1991 war in the Persian Gulf, the Navy had looked at using the Standard Missile and Aegis system that shot it off against theater missile threats like the Iraqi Scud. During that war, Aegis ships had actually been deployed into Saudi and other Gulf ports to protect them against the ballistic inbounds. But no missiles had actually been aimed that way. And so the system had never been combat tested. Instead, Aegis ships periodically sailed out to Kwajalein Atoll, where their theater missile capabilities were tested against ballistic target drones, and where, most of the time, they worked. But that wasn't quite the same, Gregory saw. An ICBM reentry vehicle had a maximum speed of about 17,000 miles per hour, or 25,000 feet per second, which was almost 10 times the speed of a rifle bullet. The problem here was, oddly enough, one of both hardware and software. The SM-2ER Block 4 missile had indeed been designed with a ballistic target in mind, to the point that its terminal guidance system was infrared. You could theoretically stealth an RV against radar, but anything plunging through the atmosphere at Mach 15-plus would heat up to the temperature of molten steel. He'd seen Minuteman warheads coming into Kwajalein from California's Vandenberg Air Force Base. They came in like man-made meteors, visible even in daylight, screaming in at an angle of 30 degrees or so, slowing down, but not visibly so, as they encountered thicker air. The trick was hitting them, or rather, hitting them hard enough to destroy them. In this, the new ones were actually easier to kill than the old ones. The original RVs had been metallic, some actually made of beryllium copper, which had been fairly sturdy. The new ones were lighter, therefore able to carry a heavier and more powerful nuclear warhead, and made from material like the tiles on the space shuttle. This was little different in feel from styrofoam and not much stronger, since it was designed only to insulate against heat, and then only for a brief span of seconds. The space shuttles had suffered damage when their 747 ferry had flown through rainstorms, and some in the ICBM business referred to large raindrops as hydrometeors for the damage they could do to a descending RV. On rare occasions when an RV had come down through a thunderstorm, relatively small hailstones had damaged them to the point that the nuclear warhead might not have functioned properly. Such a target was almost as easy to kill as an aircraft. Shooting airplanes down is easy if you hit them, not unlike dropping a pigeon with a shotgun. The trick remained hitting the damn things. Even if you got close with your interceptor, close one you know cigars. The warhead on a SAM is little different from a shotgun shell. The explosive charge destroys the metal case, converting it into jagged fragments with an initial velocity of about 5,000 feet per second. These are ordinarily quite sufficient to rip into the aluminum skin that constitutes the lift and control surfaces of the strength members of an airplane's internal framing, turning an aircraft into a ballistic object with no more ability to fly than a bird stripped of its wings. But hitting one necessitates exploding the warhead far enough from the target that the cone formed of the flying fragments intersects the space occupied by the target. For an aircraft, this is not difficult. But for a missile warhead traveling faster than the explosive-produced fragments, it is. Which explained the controversy over the Patriot missiles and the Scuds in 1991. The gadget telling the SAM warhead where and when to explode is generically called the fuse. For most modern missiles, the fusing system is a small, low-powered laser, which nutates, or turns in a circle to project its beam in a cone forward of its flight path, until the beam hits and reflects off the target. The reflected beam is received by a receptor in the laser assembly, and that generates the signal telling the warhead to explode. But quick as it is, it takes a finite amount of time, and the inbound RV is coming in very fast. So fast, in fact, that if the laser beam lacks the power for more than, say, 100 meters of range, there isn't enough time for the beam to reflect off the RV in time to tell the warhead to explode soon enough to form the cone of destruction to engulf the RV target. Even if the RV is immediately next to the SAM warhead when the warhead explodes, the RV is going faster than the fragments, which cannot hurt it because they can't catch up. And there's the problem, Gregory saw. The laser chip in the standard missile's nose wasn't very powerful, and the nutation speed was relatively slow, and that combination could allow the RV to slip right past the SAM, maybe as much as half the time, even if the SAM came within 3 meters of the target. And that was no good at all. They might actually have been better off with the old VT proximity fuse of World War II, which had used a non-directional RF emitter, instead of the new high-tech gallium arsenide laser chip. But there was room for him to play. The nutation of the laser beam was controlled by computer software, as was the fusing signal. That was something he could fiddle with. To that end, he had to talk to the guys who made it. It being the current limited production test missile, the SM-2ER Block 4. And they were the Standard Missile Company, a joint venture of Raytheon and Hughes, right up the street in McLean, Virginia. To accomplish that, he'd have Tony Brentano call ahead.
Why not let them know that their visitor was anointed by God after all?
My God, Jack, Mary Pat said.
The sun was under the yardarm. Kathy was on her way home from Hopkins, and Jack was in his private study off the Oval Office, sipping a glass of whiskey and ice with the DCI and his wife, the DDO.
When I saw this, I had to go off to the bathroom.
I hear you, MP. Jack handed her a glass of sherry, Mary Pat's favorite relaxing drink. Ed Foley picked a Samuel Adams beer in keeping with his working-class origins.
Ed?
Jack, this is totally fucking crazy, the director of Central Intelligence blurted. Fucking was not a word you usually used around the president, even this one. I mean, sure, it's from a good source and all that, but Jesus, you just don't do shit like this.
Pat Martin was in here, right? The deputy director, operations asked. She got a nod.
Well, then he told you this is damn near an act of war.
Damn near, Ryan agreed, with a small sip of his Irish whiskey.
Then he pulled out his last cigarette of the day, stolen from Mrs. Sumter, and lit it.
But it's a hard one to deny, and we have to fit this into government policy somehow or other.
We have to get George down, Ed Foley said, first of all.
And show him Zorga too? Ryan asked.
Mary Pat winced immediately.
I know we have to guard that one closely, MP, but damn it, if we can't use it to figure out these people, we're no better off than we were before we had the source.
She let out a long breath and nodded, knowing that Ryan was right, but not liking it very much.
And our internal shrink, she said. We need a doc to check this out. It's crazy enough that we probably need a medical opinion.
Next, what do we say to Sergei? Jack asked.
He knows we know.
Well, start off with, keep your head down, I suppose, Ed Foley announced.
Jack?
Yeah?
You give this to your people yet? The Secret Service, I mean?
No.
Oh, yeah.
If you're willing to commit one act of war, why not another? The DCI asked rhetorically.
And they don't have much reason to like you at the moment.
But why Golovko? MP asked the air. He's no enemy of China. He's a pro, a king spook. He doesn't have a political agenda that I know about. Sergei's an honest man.
She took another sip of sherry.
True, no political ambitions that I know of. But he is Grushevoy's tightest advisor on a lot of issues, foreign policy, domestic stuff, defense. Grushevoy likes him because he's smart and honest.
Yeah, that's rare enough in this town, too, Jack acknowledged.
That wasn't fair. He'd chosen his inner circle well, and almost exclusively of people with no political ambition, which made them an endangered species in the environs of Washington. The same was true of Golovko, a man who preferred to serve rather than to rule, in which he was rather like the American president.
Back to the issue at hand. Are the Chinese making some sort of play, and if so, what?
Nothing that I see, Jack, Foley replied, speaking for his agency in what was now an official capacity. But remember that even with Zorga, we don't see that much of their inner thinking. They're so different from us that reading their minds is a son of a bitch, and they've just taken one in the teeth, though I don't think they really know that yet.
They're going to find out in less than a week.
Oh, how's that? The DCI asked.
George Winston tells me a bunch of their commercial contracts are coming up due in less than 10 days.
We'll see then what effect this has on their commercial accounts. And so will they.
The day started earlier than usual in Beijing. Feng Gan stepped out of his official car and hurried up the steps into the building, past the uniformed guard who always held the door open for him, and this time did not get a thank-you nod from the exalted servant of the people. Feng walked to his elevator, into it, then stepped off after arriving at his floor. His office door was only a few more steps. Feng was a healthy and vigorous man for his age. His personal staff leaped to their feet as he walked in,
An hour early, they all realized. "Ming," he called on the way to his inner office.
"Yes, Comrade Minister," she said,
on going through the still-open door.
"What items have you pulled off the foreign media?"
"One moment."
She disappeared and then reappeared with a sheaf of papers in her hand.
"London Times, London Daily Telegraph, Observer, New York Times, Washington Post, Miami Herald, Boston Globe. The Western American papers are not yet available."
She hadn't included Italian or other European papers because she couldn't speak or read those languages well enough, and for some reason Fang only seemed interested in the opinions of English-speaking foreign devils. She handed over the translations. Again, he didn't thank her, even peremptorily, which was unusual for him. Her minister was exercised about something.
"What time is it in Washington?" Fang asked next.
21 hours, Comrade Minister," she answered.
"So they are watching television and preparing for bed?"
"Yes, Comrade Minister."
"But their newspaper articles and editorials are already prepared."
"That is the schedule they work, Minister. Most of their stories are done by the end of a normal working day. At the latest, news stories, aside from the truly unusual or unexpected ones, are completely done before the reporters go home for their dinner."
Fang looked up at that analysis. Ming was a clever girl, giving him information on something he'd never really thought about. With that realization, he nodded for her to go back to her desk. For their part, the American trade delegation was just boarding their plane. They were seen off by a minor consular official who spoke plastic words from plastic lips, received by the Americans through plastic ears. Then they boarded their USAF aircraft, which started up at once and began rolling toward the runway.
"So how do we evaluate this adventure, Cliff?" Mark Gant asked.
"Can you spell disaster?" Rutledge asked in return.
"That bad?"
The Assistant Secretary of State for Policy nodded soberly. "Well, it wasn't his fault, was it? That stupid Italian clergyman gets in the way of a bullet, and then the widow of that other minister person had to pray for him in public, knowing that the local government would object. And, of course, CNN had to be there for both events to stir the pot at home. How was a diplomat supposed to make peace happen if people kept making things worse instead of better?"
"That bad, Mark. China may never get a decent trade agreement if this crap keeps going on."
"All they have to do is change their own policies a little," Gant offered.
"You sound like the president."
"Cliffy, if you want to join a club, you have to abide by the club rules. Is that so hard to understand?"
"You don't treat great nations like the dentist nobody likes who wants to join the country club."
"Why is the principle different?"
"Do you really think the United States can govern its foreign policy by principle?" Rutledge asked in exasperation.
So much so, in fact, that he'd let his mind slip a gear.
"The president does, Cliff, and so does your Secretary of State," Gant pointed out.
"Well, if we want a trade agreement with China, we have to consider their point of view. You know, Cliff, if you'd been in the State Department back in 1938, maybe Hitler could have killed all the Jews without all that much of a fuss," Gant observed lightly.
It had the desired effect.
Rutledge turned and started to object.
"Wait a minute.
It was just his internal policy, Cliff, wasn't it? So what? They go to a different church? Gas 'em. Who cares?"
"Now look, Mark."
"You look, Cliff. A country has to stand for certain things, because if you don't, who the fuck are you, okay? We're in the club. Hell, we pretty much run the club. Why, Cliff? Because people know what we stand for. Now, we're not perfect. You know it. I know it. They all know it. But they also know what we will and won't do, and so we can be trusted by our friends, and by our enemies, too. And so the world makes a little sense, at least in our parts of it. And that is why we're respected, Cliff."
"And all the weapons don't matter? And all the commercial power we have, what about them?" the diplomat demanded.
"How do you think we got them, Cliffy?" Gant demanded, using the diminutive of Rutledge's name again just to bait him. "We are what we are because people from all over the world came to America to work and live out their dreams.
They worked hard. My grandfather came over from Russia because he didn't like getting fucked over by the Tsar. And he worked. And he got his kids educated. And they got their kids educated. And so now I'm pretty damned rich. But I haven't forgotten what Grandpa told me when I was little either. He told me this was the best place the world ever saw to be a Jew. Why, Cliff? Because the dead white European men who broke us away from England and wrote the Constitution had some good ideas, and they lived up to them, for the most part. That's who we are, Cliff. And that means we have to be what we are, and that means we have to stand for certain things, and the world has to see us do it.
But we have so many flaws ourselves, Rutledge protested.
Of course we do. Cliff, we don't have to be perfect to be the best around, and we never stop trying to be better. My dad, when he was in college, he marched in Mississippi, and he got his ass kicked a couple of times. But you know, it all worked out, and so now we have a black guy in the vice presidency.
From what I hear, maybe he's good enough to take one more step up someday.
Jesus, Cliff, how can you represent America to other nations if you don't get it?
Diplomacy is business, Rutledge wanted to reply. And I know how to do the business. But why bother trying to explain things to this Chicago Jew? So he rocked his seat back and tried to look dozy. Gant took the cue and stood for a 70-foot walk. The Air Force sergeants, who pretended to be stewardesses aboard, served breakfast, and the coffee was pretty decent. He found himself in the rear of the aircraft looking at all the reporters, and that felt a little bit like enemy territory, but not on reflection as much as it did sitting next to that Diplo jerk. The morning sun that lit up Beijing had done the same to Siberia even earlier in the day.
"I see our engineers are as good as ever," Bondarenko observed.
As he watched, earth-moving machines were carving a path over 100 meters wide through the primeval forests of pine and spruce. This road would serve both the gold strike and the oil fields. And this wasn't the only one. Two additional routes were being worked by a total of 12 crews. Over a third of the Russian army's available engineers were on these projects, and that was a lot of troops, along with more than half of the heavy equipment in the olive-green paint the Russian army had used for 70 years.
"This is a hero project," Colonel Aliyev said, and he was right.
The hero project idea had been created by the Soviet Union to indicate something of such great national importance that it would draw the youth of the nation in patriotic zeal. And besides, it was a good way to meet girls and see a little more of the world. This one was moving even faster than that, because Moscow had assigned the military to it. And the military was no longer worrying itself about an invasion from or into NATO. For all its faults, the Russian army still had access to a lot of human and material resources. Plus, there was real money in this project. Wages were very high for the civilians. Moscow wanted both of these resource areas brought online, and quickly. And so the goldfield workers had been helicoptered in with light equipment, with which they'd built a larger landing area, which allowed still heavier equipment to be airdropped, and with that a small rough airstrip had been built. That had allowed Russian Air Force cargo aircraft to lift in truly heavy equipment, which was now roughing in a proper air landing strip for when the crew extending the railroad got close enough to deliver the cement and rebar to create a real commercial quality airport. Buildings were going up. Some of the first things that had been sent in were the components of a sawmill, and one thing you didn't have to import into this region was wood. Large swaths were being cleared, and the trees cut down to clear them were almost instantly transformed into lumber for building. First, the sawmill workers set up their own rough cabins. Now administrative buildings were going up. And in 4 months they expected to have dormitories for over 1,000 of the miners who were already lining up for the highly paid job of digging this gold out of the ground. The Russian government had decided that the workers here would have the option of being paid in gold coin at world price, and that was something few Russian citizens wanted to walk away from. And so expert miners were filling out their application forms in anticipation of the flights into the new strike. Bondarenko wished them luck.
There were enough mosquitoes there to carry off a small child and suck him dry of blood like many vampires. Even for gold coin, it was not a place he'd want to work. The oil field was ultimately more important to his country, the general knew. Already ships were fighting their way through the late spring ice, shepherded by Navy icebreakers like the Yamal and Rossiya, to deliver the drilling equipment needed to commence proper exploration for later production. But Bondarenko had been well briefed on this subject. This oil field was no pipe dream. It was the economic salvation of his country, a way to inject huge quantities of hard currency into Russia, money to buy the things it needed to smash its way into the 21st century, money to pay the workers who'd striven so hard and so long for the prosperity they and their country deserved. And it was Bondarenko's job to guard it. Meanwhile, army engineers were furiously at work building harbor facilities so that the cargo ships would be able to land what cargo they had. The use of amphibious warfare ships, so that the Russian Navy could land the cargo on the beaches as though it were battle gear, had been examined but discarded. In many cases, the cargo to be landed was larger than the main battle tanks of the Russian army, a fact which had both surprised and impressed the commanding general of the Far East Military District. One consequence of all this was that most of Bondarenko's engineers had been stripped away for one project or another, leaving him with a few battalions organically attached to his fighting formations. And he had uses of his own for those engineers, the general grumbled. There were several places on the Chinese border where a couple of regiments could put together some very useful obstacles against invading mechanized forces. But they'd be visible, and too obviously intended to be used against Chinese forces, Moscow had told him, not caring, evidently, that the only way they could be used against the People's Liberation Army was if that army decided to come north and liberate Russia. What was it about politicians, Bondarenko thought? Even the ones in America were the same, so he'd been told by American officers he'd met. Politicians didn't really care much about what something did, but they cared a great deal about what it appeared to do. In that sense, all politicians of whatever political tilt all over the world were communists, Bondarenko thought with an amused grunt, more interested in show than reality.
When will they be finished? The general colonel asked.
They've made amazing progress, Colonel Aliyev replied. The routes will be fully roughed in, oh, another month or 6 weeks, depending on weather. The finishing work will take much longer.
You know what worries me?
What is that, Comrade General? The operations officer asked.
We've built an invasion route. For the first time, the Chinese could jump across the border and make good time to the North Siberian coast.
Before, the natural obstacles, mainly the wooded nature of the terrain, would have made that task difficult to the point of impossibility. But now there was a way to get there, and a reason to go there as well. Siberia now truly was something it had often been thought to be, a treasure house of cosmic proportions.
Treasure house, Bondarenko thought. And I am the keeper of the keys.
He walked back to his helicopter to complete his tour of the route being carved out by army engineers. Chapter 36 Zorga Reports. President Ryan awoke just before 6 in the morning. The Secret Service preferred that he keep the shades closed, thus blocking the windows. But Ryan had never wanted to sleep in a coffin, even a large one. And so when he awoke momentarily at such times as 3:53, he preferred to see some sort of light outside the window, even if only the taillights of a patrolling police car or a lonely taxicab. Over the years he'd become accustomed to waking early. That surprised him. As a boy, he'd always preferred to sleep late, especially on weekends. But Kathy had been the other way, like most doctors, and especially most surgeons, early to rise and get to the hospital, so that when you worked on a patient, you had all day to see how he or she tolerated the procedure. So maybe he'd picked it up from her, and in some sort of perverse one-upmanship, he'd come to open his eyes even earlier. Or maybe it was a more recently acquired habit in this damned place, Jack thought. as he slid off the bed and padded off to the bathroom, as another damn day started, this one like so many others, too damned early. What the hell was the matter, the president wondered. Why was it that he didn't need sleep as much anymore? Hell, sleep was one of the very few pure pleasures given to man on Earth, and all he wanted was just a little more of it. But he couldn't have it. It was just short of 6 in the morning, Jack told himself as he looked out the window. Milkmen were up, as were paper boys. Mailmen were in their sorting rooms, and in other places people who had worked through the night were ending their working days. That included a lot of people right here in the White House. Protective troops in the Secret Service, domestic staff, some people Ryan knew by sight but not by name, which fact shamed him somewhat. They were his people, after all, and he was supposed to know about them, know their names well enough to speak them when he saw the owners thereof. But there were just too many of them for him to know. Then there were the uniformed people in the White House military office, called WHAMO by insiders, who supplemented the Office of Signals. There was, in fact, a small army of men and women who existed only to serve John Patrick Ryan, and through him the country as a whole. Or that was the theory. What the hell, he thought, looking out the window. It was light enough to see. The streetlights were clicking off as their photoelectric sensors told them the sun was coming up. Jack pulled on his old Naval Academy robe, stepped into his slippers. He'd only gotten them recently. At home he just walked around barefoot. But a president couldn't do that in front of the troops, could he? And moved quietly into the corridor. There must have been some sort of bug or motion sensor close to the bedroom door, Jack thought. He never managed to surprise anyone when he came out into the upstairs corridor unexpectedly. The heads always seemed to be looking in his direction, and there was the instant morning race to see who could greet him first. The first this time was one of the senior Secret Service troops, head of the night crew. Andrea Price O'Day was still at her home in Maryland, probably dressed and ready to head out the door. What shitty hours these people worked on his behalf, Jack reminded himself, for the hour-long drive into D.C. And with luck, she'd make it home. When? Tonight? That depended on his schedule for today, and he couldn't remember offhand what he had happening. "Coffee, boss?" one of the younger agents asked.
"Sounds like a winner, Charlie."
Ryan followed him, yawning. He ended up in the Secret Service guard post for this floor, a walk-in closet, really, with a TV and a coffee pot, probably stocked by the kitchen staff, and some munchies to help the people get through the night.
"When did you come on duty?" POTUS asked.
11, sir," Charlie Malone answered.
"Boring duty?"
"Could be worse. At least I'm not working the bad check detail in Omaha anymore."
"Oh, yeah," agreed Joe Hilton, another one of the young agents on the death watch.
"I bet you played ball," Jack observed.
Hilton nodded.
"Outside linebacker, sir. Florida State University. Not big enough for the pros, though." "Only about 220, and it's all lean meat," Jack thought. Young Special Agent Hilton looked like a fundamental force of nature.
"Better off playing baseball. You make a good living, work 15 years, maybe more, and you're healthy at the end of it."
"Well, maybe I'll train my boy to be an outfielder," Hilton said.
"How old?" Ryan asked, vaguely remembering that Hilton was a recent father.
His wife was a lawyer at the Justice Department, wasn't she?
3 months.
"Sleeping through the night now, Mr. President."
"Good of you to ask."
"I wish they'd just call me Jack. I'm not God, am I?" But that was about as likely as his calling his commanding general Bobby Ray back when he'd been Second Lieutenant John P. Ryan, USMC.
"Anything interesting happened during the night?"
"Sir, CNN covered the departure of our diplomats from Beijing, but that just showed the airplane taking off. I think they just send the cameras down, halfway hoping the airplane'll blow up so that they'll have a tape of it. You know, like when the chopper comes to lift me out of here." Ryan sipped his coffee. These junior Secret Service agents were probably a little uneasy to have the boss, as he was known within the service, talking with them as if he and they were normal people. If so, Jack thought, tough shit. He wasn't going to turn into Louis XIV just to make them happy. Besides, he wasn't as good-looking as Leonardo DiCaprio, at least according to Sally, who thought that young actor was the cat's ass. Just then a messenger arrived with the day's copies of the morning's early bird. Jack took one along with the coffee and headed back to read it over. A few editorials bemoaning the recall of the trade delegation. Maybe it was the lingering liberalism in the media. The reason they were not, never had been, and probably never would be entirely comfortable with the amateur statesman in the White House. Privately, Ryan knew, they called him other things, some rather less polite. But the average Joe out there, Arnie Van Dam told Jack once a week or so, still liked him a lot. Ryan's approval rating was still very high, and the reason for it, it seemed, was that Jack was perceived as a regular guy who'd gotten lucky. If they called this luck, POTUS thought with a stifled grunt. He returned to reading the news articles, wandering back to the breakfast room as he did so, where he saw people were hustling to get things set up. Notified, doubtless, by the Secret Service that Swordsman was up and needed to be fed. Yet more of the His Majesty effect, Ryan groused. But he was hungry, and food was food, and so he wandered in, picked what he wanted off the buffet, and flipped the TV on to see what was happening in the world as he attacked his eggs Benedict. He'd have to devour them quickly before Kathy appeared to yell at him about the cholesterol intake. All around him, to a radius of 30 miles or so, the government was coming to consciousness, or what passed for it, dressing, getting in their cars, and heading in, just as he was, but not as comfortably. "Morning, Dad," Sally said, coming in next and walking to the TV, which she switched to MTV without asking. It was a long way since that bright afternoon in London when he'd been shot, Jack thought. He'd been Daddy then. In Beijing, the computer on Ming's desk had been in auto-sleep mode for just the right number of minutes. The hard drive started turning again, and the machine began its daily routine. Without lighting up the monitor, it examined the internal file of recent entries, compressed them, and then activated the internal modem to shoot them out over the net. The entire process took about 17 seconds, and then the computer went back to sleep. The data proceeded along the telephone lines in the city of Beijing until it found its destination server, which was actually in Wisconsin. There it waited for the signal that would call it up, after which it would be dumped out of the server's memory, and soon thereafter written over, eliminating any trace that it had ever existed. In any case, as Washington woke up, Beijing was heading for sleep, with Moscow a few hours behind. The earth continued its turning, oblivious of what transpired in the endless cycle of night and day.
"Well?" General Diggs looked at his subordinate.
"Well, sir," Colonel Giusti said, "I think the cavalry squadron is in pretty good shape." Like Diggs, Angelo Giusti was a career cavalryman. His job as commander of 1st Armored's Cavalry Squadron, actually a battalion, but the Cav had its own way of speaking, was to move out ahead of the division proper, locating the enemy and scouting out the land, being the eyes of Old Ironsides, but with enough combat power of its own to look after itself. A combat veteran of the Persian Gulf War, Giusti had smelled the smoke and seen the elephant. He knew what his job was, and he figured he had his troopers trained up about as well as circumstances in Germany allowed. He actually preferred the free-form play allowed by simulators to the crowded training fields of the Combat Maneuver Training Center, which was barely 75 square kilometers. It wasn't the same as being out there in your vehicles, but neither was it restricted by time and distance. And on the global SimNet system, you could play against a complete enemy battalion. Even a brigade if you wanted your people to get some sweat in their play. Except for the bumpy float sensation of driving your Abrams around, some tankers got motion sickness from that, it conveyed the complexity better than any place except the NTC at Fort Irwin in the California desert,
or the comparable facility the army had established for the Israelis in the Negev. Diggs couldn't quite read the younger officer's mind, but he just watched the quarter horse move around with no lack of skill. They'd played against some Germans, and the Germans, as always, were pretty good at the war business. But not today as good as 1st Tank's cavalry troopers, who'd first outmaneuvered their European hosts, and then, to the surprise and distaste of the German brigadier who'd supervised the exercise, set an ambush that had cost them half a battalion of their Leos, as the Americans called the Leopard 2 main battle tanks. Diggs would be having dinner with the brigadier later today. Even the Germans didn't know night fighting as well as the Americans did, which was odd since their equipment was roughly comparable, and their soldiers pretty well trained. But the German army was still largely a conscript army, most of whose soldiers didn't have the time in service the Americans enjoyed. In the wider exercise, the cavalry part had just been the real segment of a wider command post exercise, or CPX. Colonel Don Lyle's 2nd Brigade was handling the fuller, if theoretical, German attack quite capably. On the whole, the Bundeswehr was not having a good day. Well, it no longer had the mission of protecting its country against a Soviet invasion, and with that had gone the rather furious support of the citizenry that the West German Army had enjoyed for so many years. Now the Bundeswehr was an anachronism with little obvious purpose, and the occupier of a lot of valuable real estate for which Germans could think up some practical uses. And so the former West German Army had been downsized and mainly trained to do peacekeeping duty, which, when you got down to it, was heavily armed police work. The New World Order was a peaceful one, at least so far as Europeans were concerned. The Americans had engaged in combat operations to the rather distant interest of the Germans, who, while they'd always had a healthy interest in war fighting, were now happy enough that their interest in it was entirely theoretical, rather like a particularly intricate Hollywood production. It also forced them to respect America a little more than they would have preferred. But some things couldn't be helped. "Well, Angelo, I think your troopers have earned themselves a beer or two at the local gas houses. That envelopment you accomplished at 0220 was particularly adroit." Giusti grinned and nodded his appreciation. "Thank you, General. I'll pass that one along to my S3. He's the one who thought it up." "Later, Angelo."
"Roger that one, sir."
Lieutenant Colonel Giusti saluted his divisional commander on his way.
"Well, Duke?"
Colonel Masterman pulled a cigar out of his BDU jacket and lit it up. One nice thing about Germany was that you could always get good Cuban ones here.
"I've known Angelo since Fort Knox. He knows his stuff, and he had his officers particularly well trained. Even had his own book on tactics and battle drill printed up."
"Oh?" Diggs turned. "Is it any good?"
"Not bad at all," the G3 replied. "I'm not sure that I agree with it all, but it doesn't hurt to have everyone singing out of the same hymnal. His officers all think pretty much the same way. So Angelo's a good football coach. Sure enough, he kicked the Kraut's asses last night."
Masterman closed his eyes and rubbed his face.
"These night exercises take it out of you."
"How's Lyle doing?"
"Sir, last time I looked, he had the Germans well contained. Our friends didn't seem to know what he had around them. They were putzing around trying to gather information. Short version, Giusti won the reconnaissance battle, and that decided things. Again."
"Again," Diggs agreed.
If there was any lesson out of the National Training Center, it was that one. Reconnaissance and counter-reconnaissance. Find the enemy. Don't let the enemy find you. If you pulled that off, it was pretty hard to lose. If you didn't, it was very hard to win.
How's some sleep grab you, Duke?"
"It's good to have a CG who looks after his troopers, mon général."
Masterman was sufficiently tired that he didn't even want a beer first. And so, with that decided, they headed for Diggs's command UH-60 Blackhawk helicopter for the hop back to the divisional caserne. Diggs particularly liked the 4-point safety belt. It made it a lot easier to sleep sitting up.
One of the things I have to do today, Ryan told himself, is figure out what to do about the Chinese attempt on Sergei. He checked his daily briefing sheet. Robbie was out west again. That was too bad. Robbie was both a good sounding board and a source of good ideas. So he'd talk it over with Scott Adler, if he and Scott both had holes in their day, and the Foleys. Who else? Jack wondered. Damn, whom else could he trust with this? If this one leaked to the press, there'd be hell to pay. Okay, Adler had to be there. He'd actually met that Zhang guy. And if some Chinese minister type had owned a piece of this, then he'd be the one, wouldn't he? Probably. Not certainly, however. Ryan had been in the spook business too long to make that mistake. When you made certainty assumptions about things you weren't really sure about, you frequently walked right into a stone wall head first, and that could hurt. Ryan punched a button on his desk. Ellen?
Yes, Mr. President?
Later today I need Scott Adler and the Foleys in here. It'll take about an hour. Find me a hole in the schedule, will you?
About 2:30, but it means putting off the Secretary of Transportation's meeting about the air traffic control proposals.
Make it so, Ellen. This one's important, he told her.
Yes, Mr. President.
It was by no means perfect. Ryan preferred to work on things as they popped into his mind. But, as president, you quickly learned that you served the schedule, not the other way around. Jack grimaced. So much for the illusion of power. Mary Pat Foley strolled into her office, as she did nearly every morning, and, as always, turned on her computer. If there was one thing she'd learned from Zorga, it was to turn the damn thing all the way off when she wasn't using it. There was a further switch on her phone line that manually blocked it, much as if she'd pulled the plug out of the wall. She flipped that, too. It was an old story for an employee of an intelligence service. Sure, she was paranoid, but was she paranoid enough? Sure enough, there was another email from seagood@jadecastle.com. Chet Nomori was still at work, and this download took a mere 23 seconds. With the download complete, she made sure she'd backed it up, then clobbered it out of her inbox so that no copies remained even in the ether world. Next, she printed it all up and called down for Joshua Sears to do the translations and some seat-of-the-pants analysis. Zorga had become routine in handling, if not in importance, and by 8:45 she had the translation in hand.
"Oh, Lord, Jack's just going to love this one," the DDO observed at her desk.
Then she walked the document to Ed's larger office facing the woods. That's when she found out about the afternoon trip to the White House. Mary Abbott was the official White House makeup artist. It was her job to make the president look good on TV, which meant making him look like a cheap whore in person, but that couldn't be helped. Ryan had learned not to fidget too much, which made her job easier. But she knew he was fighting the urge, which both amused and concerned her.
"How's your son doing at school?" Ryan asked.
"Just fine, thank you. And there's a nice girl he's interested in." Ryan didn't comment on that. He knew that there had to be some boy or boys at St. Mary's who found his Sally highly interesting. She was pretty, even to disinterested eyes. But he didn't want to think about that. It did make him grateful for the Secret Service, however. Whenever Sally went on a date, there would be at least a chase car full of armed agents close by, and that would take the starch out of most teenaged boys. So the USSS did have its uses, eh? Girl children, Jack thought, were God's punishment on you for being a man. His eyes were scanning his briefing sheets for the mini-press conference, the likely questions and the better sorts of answers to give to them. It seemed very dishonest to do it this way, but some foreign heads of government had the question pre-screened so that the answers could be properly canned. Not a bad idea in the abstract, Jack thought, but the American media would spring for that about as quickly as a coyote would chase after a whale.
There.
Mrs. Abbott said, as she finished touching up his hair. Ryan stood, looked in the mirror, and grimaced as usual.
"Thank you, Mary," he managed to say.
"You're welcome, Mr. President."
And Ryan walked out, crossing the hall from the Roosevelt Room to the Oval Office, where the TV equipment was set up. The reporters stood when he entered, as the kids at St. Matthew's had stood when the priest came into class. But in third grade, the kids asked easier questions. Jack sat down in a rocking swivel chair. Kennedy had done something similar to that, and Arnie thought it a good idea for Jack as well. The gentle rocking that a man did unconsciously in the chair gave him a homey look, the spin experts all thought. Jack didn't know that, and knowing it would have caused him to toss the chair out the window. But Arnie did, and he'd eased the president into it merely by saying it looked good, and getting Kathy Ryan to agree. In any case, Swordsman sat down and relaxed in the comfortable chair, which was the other reason Arnie had foisted it on him, and the real reason why Ryan had agreed. It was comfortable. "We ready?" Jack asked. When the president asked that, it usually meant, "Let's get this fucking show on the road." But Ryan thought it was just a question. Kristen Matthews was there to represent NBC. There were also reporters from ABC and Fox, plus a print reporter from the Chicago Tribune. Ryan had come to prefer these more intimate press conferences, and the media went along with it because the reporters were assigned by lot, which made it fair, and everyone had access to the questions and answers. The other good thing, from Ryan's perspective, was that a reporter was less likely to be confrontational in the Oval Office than in the raucous locker room atmosphere of the press room, where the reporters tended to bunch together in a mob and adopt a mob mentality.
"Mr. President," Kristen Matthews began, "you've recalled both the trade delegation and our ambassador from Beijing. Why was that necessary?"
Ryan rocked a little in the chair.
"Kristen, we all saw the events in Beijing that so grabbed the conscience of the world, the murder of the cardinal and the minister, followed by the roughing up, to use a charitable term for it, of the minister's widow and some members of the congregation." He went on to repeat the points he'd made in his previous press conference, making particular note of the Chinese government's indifference to what had happened. "One can only conclude that the Chinese government doesn't care." "Well, we care. The American people care. And this administration cares. You cannot take the life of a human being as casually as though you are swatting an insect. The response we received was unsatisfactory, and so I recalled our ambassador for consultations."
"But the trade negotiations, Mr. President," the Chicago Tribune broke in.
"It is difficult for a country like the United States of America to do business with a nation which does not recognize human rights. You've seen for yourself what our citizens think of all this. I believe you will find that they find those murders as repellent as I do, and, I would imagine, as you do yourself. And so you will not recommend to Congress that we normalize trading relations with China?"
Ryan shook his head.
"No, I will not so recommend, and even if I did, Congress would rightly reject such a recommendation."
"At what time might you change your position on this issue?"
"At such time as China enters the world of civilized nations and recognizes the rights of its common people, as all other great nations do."
"So you are saying that China today is not a civilized country?"
Ryan felt as though he'd been slapped across the face with a cold, wet fish. But he smiled and went on.
"Killing diplomats is not a civilized act, is it?"
"What will the Chinese think of that?" Fox asked.
"I cannot read their minds. I do call upon them to make amends.